So I had a unique experience in my life to go to seminary a year ahead of my dad. He went a year after me, and so we got to take many of the same classes together. And there was one year in seminary, or a semester that I had, that I actually added things up, because there's a tremendous amount of reading. It was like 6,000 pages to read through in one semester. And I had a great gift for that, which is that I can kind of grab things pretty quickly, and I kind of know when it's good enough. Like, okay, I got your argument. I'm in favor of it. I understand it completely. Let me look ahead to when you begin a new one, and I'll kind of continue on with that. I get the general idea. I'm ready to go. There I am. My dad didn't quite share that same gifting and punished himself by reading every single letter of every single word of every single page over those things. And I tell him, Dad, you're there. You've got it. You can move on to something. You don't have to do all of this stuff. But he didn't seem able to move beyond to that sense of doing good enough, right? But that's an idea that we all kind of deal with, right? Every one of us in our life has at some point said, this is good enough. When I went to college in Texas and I was living in Colorado, when I would drive between the two, right? I identified for myself a speed limit that was good enough. Do you understand? Right? It was safe enough that I wasn't endangering other people around you in my own mind, but also allowed me to somewhat cut down this 17-plus hour trip a little bit more, because it was good enough, right? I wasn't obscene. I wasn't doing 95 along the highway or anything like that. It was just good enough, right? And we've all found those little spaces, right? I mean, if you've gone to school at all, you've found a good enough somewhere. If you've been at work, you've found a good enough, right? Okay, it's going to pass inspection. It's going to be enough. It'll get us there. Can you just take a moment for yourself and think of one time, it doesn't even have to be personal, that you've seen either yourself or someone else do a good enough? And just share it with someone else around you. Where has it been good enough? Feel free to laugh. Good smiles all around, right? Not a hard place to connect to, because all of us are human beings, and we kind of live by that motto. Like, if you're honest and you look far enough, like, yeah, there's a lot of places in my life that good enough is kind of the motto. And honestly, if you don't have the capacity to live by good enough at least somewhere in your life, then you're going to need some professional help. Without any joke at all, right? This is what OCD actually is. Obsessive compulsive disorder, which is a real designation apart from when we joke about it in people's lives, where people are not able to say, I have cleaned this good enough. I've done this good enough. Right? There's this perfection that just drives, right? And it crushes. So there's a freedom for us to be able to say, I've done that good enough. All right, I can move on to something else because I've released myself from that. Now, we come into the space because we want to interact with God, who is different than us. And just a good warning for you, God does not have a good enough category in his mind. All right, so there's a lot of tension that we have with God, because there's a lot of times we're like, God, this is good enough. And he doesn't have that in his capacity. He never once says, oh yeah, that's good enough. He always presses on for something greater. He always moves for something greater. And that cuts both ways. I mean, it cuts all the times you're like, man, I'm just done. Like, this is the best you'll ever get out of me. And God's like, nah, we're going to keep pressing for more, right? There's something deeper we can get to. And that's been frustrating. We'd be happy if he'd lay off on some of those things. But it's on the blessing side, too. And we saw that last week with Abraham, right? When he's like, God, this will be good enough to give my inheritance to my servant. It'd be good enough to give my inheritance to this son that I had from someone other than Sarah. And all the way through, God's saying, no, that's not good enough. I've got something greater, something bigger for you. And so we are interacting with a God who engages in your life that says that the dreams and hopes that you have are not good enough. There's something better that I have for you. And so that calling last week to kind of release yourself, to surrender yourself to his better rather than just your good enough. Like, this will kind of be okay, God. I can make it through life there. And God says, there is something even greater than that that I want to give to you. In Mark 10, 21, the same thing happens, right, with Jesus and that rich young ruler. He says, hey, you're going to heaven? Yeah, check the boxes. I'm good. I'm going there, right? I'm being obedient in all these places. Most of us would say, that's good enough, God. I mean, you got the guy to have faith. You got him to be obedient to the major parts of the Ten Commandments, right? That's good enough. Move on to somebody else. There's so many people that aren't there at all. But Jesus comes back to the young man. He looks at him and he loves him. And he says, oh man, this is good. It's all good. It's just not good enough. I have something greater that I want to offer to you, something larger that I want to invite you to. And this again is the challenge, but the opportunity that God is laying before us as believers. He says, I don't want you to be satisfied with good enough. I want to resurrect hope in your heart. We talked about that last week. Because there's something larger than that that I want to give to you. Something bigger than that I want to provide for you. We have this theme for this sermon series called the Grand Invitation. So it makes sense for us to maybe pause a little bit today and kind of consider what the invitation is that we're getting from God, right? So we have a background that's up there, which is a wedding invitation, right? So anyone ever been to a wedding before? Great, right? So these are familiar to you. You've seen these come in your mail, all those kinds of things before. Without being braggadocious at all, I've probably been to more than most of you, maybe more than a whole bunch of you combined. That's kind of part of my life. It's a fun part of things. So I get these a lot, right? So think a little bit about what it means to be invited to a wedding, right? Whether you've actually been invited to a wedding, as most of us have, or you at least are familiar enough in our culture from that concept, I'd like you to think for a moment, what is expected if I accept an invitation to a wedding? What does that mean? And once again, we'll do a little bit of that this morning, but I think it's all super safe to do. You can't really fail at this. So I'd like you to turn to somebody around you and just say, hey, if I accept a wedding invitation, these are kind of the baseline expectations that are there for me, right? So turn to someone around you and say, hey, accept a wedding invitation. This is what is expected to come out of me as a result of that. All right. Probably some good answers. Let's try to maybe share a few as a bigger group. Anyone want to offer one of their amazing, brilliant answers? Or a so-so answer? Tom, yeah.
Show up, bring a gift.
Show up, bring a gift. Yeah, yeah. Obviously, if you're saying I'm coming, then you actually should come, right? It would be rude to not come, right? So part of that is saying, hey, I'm actually going to be present at the actual event day. And a gift is pretty much always expected, even if they're like, it's kind of like, it's a little gauche to not bring one, a little awkward, right? To show up and say, I'm just here for the food, you know? You can push it to that limit if you want to, but that is a reasonable expectation. What are some other expectations of accepting an invitation? Appropriate dress, yeah. Yeah, so not merely showing up. Like, hey, I just came from, you know, my soccer game, or I just came from hanging out at the beach, or I just came from a workout or whatever. Hopefully you've at least taken a shower and done some personal hygiene stuff and put on something clean, etc., and you look nice, appropriate for the environment around. Yeah, that's expected too. What is another expectation? RSVP, kind of a response back. A communication, and when they offer that to you, that you're going to say, hey, yeah, this is something I want to connect to, right? So a wedding invitation is an invitation to a specific event, right? So there's a whole lot of things that are not expected. You're not expected to help plan the wedding, right, if you have an invitation to that. You're not expected to set up or tear down afterwards. You're not expected to be present in their life on every anniversary, right? I mean, there's not a commitment that, hey, every year on this day, I will be in your life again. There's not an expectation that you have to even remember the anniversary at sometime later on. Facebook will remind it for you or something else. Well, if you need it, right? So there's not this huge long-term commitment. It is a commitment to a party, a commitment to be engaged in the party enough to be dressed appropriately, bring a gift, and probably at least at some level that when you're at the party, you're not being a bump on the log, right? You know, if they're doing the chicken dance, then just get up and do the chicken dance, right? You know, if they're, you know, having the cake cutting, go up and watch them cut the cake. I mean, somehow be a part of what's going on. So overall, being invited to a wedding is not a tremendously taxing kind of thing for us, right? Assuming the time is available in your life, then you're like, yeah, it won't overwhelm me or blow me away. I can probably afford a gift. I can probably show up. It'll be a good time for me and them. Boom. So sometimes Christianity is viewed as this kind of an invitation. That there is a God who comes to you and says, I want to invite you to this amazing party, right? And so the whole goal then is to say, will you RSVP to God? Will you come down front? Will you pray the right prayer? Will you somehow kind of express the right faith at some level that says, yes, I have RSVP'd to God. I'm going to get baptized, which is my primary RSVPing to God back and saying, hey, I'm going to be there. Save me a place in that mansion. Carve out another room for me. I'm excited for it. Ready for that day. Send me any updates along the way. I'm kind of expected along the lines that somehow as you're waiting for that you're at least going to get some gift, right? We kind of understand maybe you cannot do any gift at all, but that is a little awkward. So a little bit of gift, you know, for the one who invited you is appropriate. And some kind of communication back and forth is great, but not this huge long-term investment of things, right? So there is a way of looking at Christianity in the same way that we look at a wedding invitation, right? It's a great party. I don't want to miss it. I love the people that are there. I want other people to be with me. I want to RSVP to that thing. And when that time comes, I definitely want to be a part of that. But there are other forms of invitations that we get. Other invitations that happen. And I want to show you a video that will highlight one of those for you right now.
Oh, yeah. 105 is the number that comes to my head. When I think of all the years I want to be with you. Wake up every morning with you in my bed. That's precisely what I plan to do. And you know one of these days, when I get my money right, buy you everything and show you all the finer things in life. We'll forever be in love, so there ain't no need to rush. But one day I won't be able to ask you loud enough. I'll say, well,
I just got to confess, I spent a little bit too much time this week looking at surprise marriage proposals on YouTube. So lots of fun out there to be had. A different invitation, right? How many of you have ever been a part of an invitation like that? Ever been married? Yeah. So even for those of you that haven't, like we can still look at that too. What are the expectations of saying yes to that invitation? If someone has that invitation for you and you say yes to it, what are the natural expectations that come along with that? So one more time, last time, just turn to someone around you, easy enough because marriage is a part of our whole culture. What's expected if you say yes? Turn to someone around you, say, hey, this is at least one expectation that comes if you say yes to that. It's an invitation, just like the invitation to a wedding. But it's not asking you to clear one day, right? When that guy got down on his knees, he's not saying, hey, I'm hoping that we can at least get an afternoon evening together at some point in the future. Right? It is an invitation pretty unique in our human experience. It's an invitation to clear the rest of the calendar for the rest of your life. Not just to squeeze in a moment or two here and there, but to say, will you just free up the rest of your life for me? Right? There's no invitation like that. There's no invitation that's quite that bold. It's not an invitation that says, hey, could you somehow, you know, maybe within whatever price range you have, bring an appropriate gift. It is an invitation that says, will you put it all out there, every dime that you have, and hold nothing back, that we can just share it all together. And I'll share all of mine, and you'll share all of yours, and that's what the invitation is. It says, will you give all of your time, all of your life, all of your body, right? There is no halfsies on any of that. It is this bold and beautiful invitation, and one that captures our hearts like nothing else. I looked on YouTube for like surprise wedding invitation. It's not there, right? I mean, there's no one videotaping this surprise receiving a wedding invitation for a friend. It's just not at the same level, right? Okay, it's a wedding. All right, I've got those before. I can figure that out, plan it out in my life, right? What's beautiful is this surprise invitation into all of me. And so there is this other way of looking at Christianity and seeing this bridegroom that comes to you individually. And this Jesus who gets down on his knee in front of you and to your face says, will you marry me? That metaphor is used over and over again in the Bible. It is a very biblical one because he means it. It's not an invitation to a party. It's not an invitation to hey, can we hang out sometime later on? It's not an invitation even to a dating relationship. It is an invitation from Jesus that says, will you clear out the rest of your life for me? And I'll clear out mine for you. It's mutual, right? Will you take all of the money that you possess and will you just lay it at my feet? Because I'm going to take all the riches that I possess and I'm going to lay them at your feet and we're going to do something together. And will you grab my hand and we'll go through this life together and we will together do some of the things that you really love doing and we will together do some of the things that I really love doing. Will you marry me? And there's no place in there, right, for that woman in the video, like to come back. Like it's not saying, hey, this is great, I'd love to have that every Sunday, right? That'd be really unnatural, really weird, right? The natural flow out of that is either to say, no, I don't want that, or yes, I do. But not to carve out some balanced thing where I need to keep about 60% of the money for me, but then I'm willing to put 40% in there. And I know marriages that try to mess around on those things. All I'll say is that you're missing the point. It's about this openness and this trust. And if you can't release your money and your time and your heart, then there's things you need to look at in that relationship. So this invitation that we're speaking about over these weeks is this invitation not to a wedding. It is an invitation from Jesus that says, will you marry me? It's the invitation that James picks up for us too. And I think that maybe that metaphor helps us understand that. I realize too that many of you are single right now. Maybe we'll be single the rest of your lives or wherever you are in that state. This is not like exclusive of you. Like the metaphor exists for what it is because it's one that we can all identify with and we all understand. Whether you're personally experiencing it right now doesn't matter, because it points to this invitation from Jesus. So you can move past whatever that is for any individual marriage situation in your life. That's not really the point of it. The point of it is there is a God who says, I want you to have that same absolute commitment with me, and I'll have it with you. It's the invitation from Jesus. And James picks that up. And sometimes, and Martin Luther had some issues with James on this too, with that issue of faith. I just want to read it through and see if we can tweak that word faith into love. I think they're pretty tightly connected together. Paul actually says that love is a greater value out of those things in 1 Corinthians 13. But let's see if that gives any clarity for us. What good is it, my brothers and my sisters, if someone claims to have love but never acts on it? Right? If you knew somebody that had pictures of a wedding all over their house, they wore a wedding ring, even had their vow kind of inscribed on the wall somewhere, like, yeah, and yet never spent time with their spouse. You never saw them together. They never spoke of their spouse. They never engaged. They never had any connection whatsoever. You would say, well, what? How does this even get connected together, right? It would be unnatural. I know the picture back there is weird. I'll just explain it for a moment, right? So one of those little chicks is natural, and one of them is not. Clear enough, right? So what we're looking at is, what is the natural response to this invitation from Jesus? The natural response is that I'm going to love you back. It is unnatural to say I'm just going to say the words that I need to have, or I'm going to have this intellectual faith, but I'm going to divorce it from anything in my own life. That is not a natural response to that. In verse 15, suppose then that somebody comes to you without clothes and without food, and one of you says, I love you. Keep warm, be well fed, but does absolutely nothing. Would you say that's love? What do the words matter if there's no action behind it? In the same way, love all by itself, if not accompanied by action, is a dead love. There's no reality to that. You foolish men and women, do you want evidence again that love without any deeds is useless? And then we come back to the story we had from last week. Wasn't our ancestor Abraham considered loving of God when he offered his own son Isaac on the altar? Don't you see that his love and his actions worked together, and his love was made complete by what he did? And the scripture then was fulfilled that Abraham loved God, and it was credited to him as full and true love, and he was called God's friend. Now, I'm not advocating switching out words all over Scripture as this kind of goal in life. I think leaving the word faith in there is the best interpretation. But I think that if we use that word love, it helps us again to understand. Because there are some times that we still separate faith into this intellectual thing. And we have a statement of faith, as though somehow you can read off a creed, and if you say it in here, that means that you really believe it, even though it may not produce anything in your life. But we haven't yet done that really to the word love. Like, pretty much universally, whether you're a person of faith or not, whether you have any religious belief or not, we still recognize that love requires action. And anywhere that you roam around this world, if you see someone trumpeting love with their mouth, saying, intellectually, I have love for you, but it doesn't require me to do anything about it, we would call a foul on that, right? You would throw the flag and you would say, that's not really love. If all you can do is say, I have the boldest predictions and the boldest words about my incredible love and compassion for people that are homeless or people that are caught in addictions or people that are wherever else they are, right? If you can say the richest, most beautiful things and never do anything in your life, we might call you a great speaker. We might call you a great encourager or motivator. But I think all of us would be able to say, it's not quite love. And so I want to be able to come back to what James is speaking about so that we understand that if anybody says, I have a faith that never produces action in my life, that we would also be able to come back and say, nah, I'm not sure that's faith. I'm not sure how you're understanding faith. I'm not sure what you're making that out to be. But to divorce those things completely, which is kind of our Western thing to put all these things in categorical boxes. But the Bible just doesn't do that much. Right? You can't make this a theological statement because it's a personal relationship. It is Jesus coming to you and saying, I want to marry you. And there's no legitimate response when someone's down on their knees offering you a ring for you to say, I'm all in. I love this marriage idea. Would love to be married to you. Maybe we could find a time to connect once a week in our marriage. Maybe a little bit of my time or money I could devote to you. Right? That's not what it's about. So there's this invitation from Jesus that says, I'm inviting you to a place of faith. Faith not in a truth, but faith in the person of truth. Will you then come and believe on me? Trust in me, walk with me, follow me, marry me. It's all kind of stuck in there together. And it is as beautiful as any wedding proposal you've ever seen. It is the fullest amount of love you'll ever get. So my goal is not for you to look back in the past and consider where that faith has been, but just for you to take that today. To take that invitation that Jesus brings you in this moment as he comes to you and says, will you give me your whole life and I'll give you mine? And will you walk with me? And an invitation right now to say, yes, I believe. And whatever flows out of that belief naturally, I'm ready to invest in you. Will you pray with me? Jesus, we thank you that you love us deeply. We thank you, God, for the experience of marriage in our world and culture. We thank you for the reminder that when done well and beautifully, it is an amazing commitment of life to life. But God, we thank you even more that you have given us something greater in you. And it cuts across whether marriage fits into our own lives because there is a marriage to Jesus that is for every one of us. And I pray, Jesus, that our hearts respond with a full faith. That we hear the fullness of a gospel. That it's not an invitation to a party at some point in the future. It is an invitation to Jesus. And to lose ourselves in him as he pours himself into us. And to walk with him every day. To wake up with him every morning. To live with him every moment.